James O'Brien on LBC.
It's 10:36. You're listening to LBC on a day when our chief reporter, Tom Swarbrick, has unearthed almost mind-boggling statistics with regard to investigations currently underway into child sex abuse in this country. Some people will be less surprised by it than others, though. People like the lady we spoke to a moment ago, Laura, who have lived not only with the abuse, but with the knowledge that other people will look the other way. What I'm trying to do today is come to a better understanding, A, of how that happens, and I think we're all guilty of it in a sense, and I'm sorry to labour this point, because I may be doing you a grave disservice, but when you hear what we're tackling on the programme, and you hear that again we're returning to this issue, I wouldn't be surprised, I certainly wouldn't blame you, if a little bit of you balks slightly at the discomforting nature of what you're going to hear, and I think that is the seed from which looking the other way, when coupled with self-interest, often grows. And that's what I'm trying to understand, how we fix that. One phrase you're probably familiar with is mandatory reporting, so that when somebody is made aware of an allegation by a young person, a burden falls upon them to do the right thing, rather than relying upon their conscience. There is a sort of mechanism in place that would act as a catalyst, if you will, for reporting, to make it compulsory, to make it mandatory. No one has worked harder in this field than my studio guest now, Tom Perry, who himself attended Caldecott School. You'll remember when a former schoolmate of his, Ian McFadyen, confronted Nick Clegg on this radio station about why he hadn't done more to help his contemporaries who were abused at that school by the headmaster and another teacher. The former headmaster, of course, has been jailed. The other teacher passed away before he could be. Tom joins me, actually threw himself under a train before he could be jailed. Tom joins me again, not for the first time, in the studio now. First of all, I'll check with you that I haven't misspoken so far, because I'm very conscious of journalists and well-meaning folk wading into a world that you've inhabited since your childhood, and sometimes getting the facts wrong and getting the words wrong, Tom.
No, I think, good morning, James. I think you're doing actually pretty well. There is one further aspect that I chip in from that introduction, and that is, of course, there's a big narrative which is going to be pushed, I think, very shortly by the Home Office, who are shaping up for this, is that, you know, it really is down to children to report. I mean, this is the most absurd notion, because what it says is, well, children should report, but the adults can sit on their hands and keep their mouth shut. And I'm really very troubled by this, because this is a crime, and it's a unique crime in this regard, because most often, with child abuse, there are two parties who want to keep the abuse secret, the perpetrator and the victim.
Of course.
And I was a victim, and I kept it secret for a mere 38 years. Okay? Now, did anybody know or suspect about my abuse? Well, can I tell you, they did, most certainly, because when I was 11, sitting at a dining table, I looked over at the table that I hoped to sit at as captain of rugby, which I achieved.
Okay.
And I used to watch the captain of rugby take tea up to the teacher in question, and then not return. Now, everyone was meant to be at breakfast, including all the teachers. Why didn't he return? Everybody saw it. All the adults saw it. Everybody knew. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to do that one day. My brain couldn't go there. I didn't know anything about this.
Of course.
I took tea up. I didn't return. And what happened to me whilst I was away is that I was abused. So adults knew. Adults, not knew. They suspected.
That, you know, I was about
they
to
suspected.
Say. They suspected. Yes.
And it's that suspicion. What do you report? A child's taking tea up to a room. Well, so what?
They choose to ignore it. It was the dark room at my prep school.
There we are.
And very similarly, I find it impossible to believe that the adults weren't aware of what we were aware of.
Precisely.
Can you begin to understand, not excuse, I think I've been at great pains to distinguish between explain and excuse, the impulse that prompts a person to look the other way in those sorts of circumstances?
Do you know, I can. And
really?
Actually, I really can. It is utter fear and terror. Now, it'll be different in different places. If you take my school, and, you know, this is my experiential understanding, we subsequently discovered years later that the headmaster actually had taken an the man who became the headmaster had taken an interest in the school, and he owned a percentage of the operation. We didn't know this. The staff most certainly would have known it, but we did not, except one pupil who he told, okay, which was very strange. So therefore, if they say anything, what's going to happen to the member of staff? They could kiss goodbye to a 20-year career. Why are they going to do that? It's often self-preservation. It's a fear of alienation. You know, it is It is an emotionally fraught area, because if you're wrong, you're going to be crucified. And that is because...
And even if you're right, you're opening up a whole world of trouble.
Well, you are, but if you're right, and there is a requirement to report, OK, a suspicion on reasonable grounds, you are, one, protected, you are required to do it, so the wind is in your sails, you have a power equilibrium, and that is what's missing at the moment, because imagine Savile, for example. We know that a producer went into a room where Savile was his dressing room, and he was abusing a 14-year-old girl. The woman was a 21-year-old runner, basically. And she reported it, and, of course, nothing happened. Now, she has a power differentiation, huge power differentiation. It's Savile or her.
Yes.
That's the bottom line of it, which is why it is so important that we have this law, because it provides power equilibrium.
And the law would be applied in this case to whoever the 21-year-old woman spoke to, not to her.
It would apply. No, it would apply to her, because she is then protected by the law.
Right.
She is following the law. She is no longer speaking as a whistleblower. And that's the problem we have.
Is everyone is a whistleblower. You have to be rogue. You have to go rogue. Off diary, as it were.
It's absurd.
So it's a huge burden to put on anybody's shoulders, let alone someone suffering from the power differential that you describe.
I heard an appalling story recently about a woman in a special educational needs. They knew the girl was being abused. She described how they knew the girl was being abused, and I have to say that was pretty grim.
Yeah.
She tried to report it to the head. The head... mumbled, it seems, something to the governors, she was told to make it go away. She needed the job. She was a single mum. Where did she go? First rule of life, self-protection, self-preservation. Where do you go? Now, had there been law, she is presented with something else, an entirely different perspective. She's doing right. And even if the investigation results in a question mark and no substantiation, she's done right. And she cannot be hung out to dry for it. That is going to change the culture. At the moment, all child protection is at the moment in this country, in regulated activities, is a value judgment. Well, you know, I mean, it's not working. It's a failed system. It's defunct.
Forgive me if I've misinterpreted this. The new narrative, because one thing I've discovered since we've started talking to men and women abusees is that they often seem to have a slightly different interpretation of what is being presented to the public than the people doing the presenting. In some cases, the journalist; in most cases, the politician. So when you talk to me about this new narrative set to emerge from the Home Office that will put the burden on the children, that's the first time I've heard of this, and it seems to be at odds with the move towards mandatory reporting that some of the charities and the politicians have been heralding. They're two very distinct things, aren't they?
Well, yes, there are. At this stage, James, as you know, when we last spoke, which I think was in August, you know, a very strange announcement had been made by the NSPCC.
That's right, but we didn't know it was strange until you came
unintelligible.
In. Yes.
And it's since been worsened. We now have what I could only describe as pretend mandatory reporting. It's not. I mean, you've got to understand the entire framework and what's being pitched by the NSPCC. It is pretend mandatory reporting. And we're not going to get there until such time as the government starts engaging. We had in the House of Lords last week, we had an amendment to the Serious Crimes Bill to introduce mandatory reporting. It was withdrawn by Baroness Walmsley at the end, and we now have a consultation on mandatory reporting. I do feel as though we've been pushed into the long grasses of South Dakota in the prairie, you know?
Yes. Why? Why do you feel that? And why do you think that's happening? Actually, I'm going to have to take some travel news.
Oh.
But when we return, we can start to find out. Because we said earlier, last week, I think, when we sort of, many of us, the people listening and myself, sort of said this is a stopped clock day. This is where, actually, we do believe that there are tentacles reaching up into the loftiest echelons of our society. And normally when people start talking like that, it all goes a little bit tinfoil hat and it all goes a little bit moon landings and 911 conspiracies. But this is the exception that proves the rule, isn't it? And
yes.
We'll move on to that after this.